This Frontenas podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. This is Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. A mixed-race, revolutionary-era Mexican soldier who has an urge to build bridges across the border. A Mexican-American girl not allowed to speak Spanish at home speaks in code with her grandfather. The child of immigrants and a group of survivors go on an impossible mission to save the Statue of Liberty from being towed away by the Chinese in post-apocalyptic flooded New York. These are just a few of the stories told by writer Rudy Ruiz. Ruiz is a native of the border, born in Brownsville, and the border often plays a starring role in his fiction, which is rich with magical realism. His 2013 short story collection, Seven for the Revolution, earned recognition at the 2014 International Latino Book Awards, including first place in Best Popular Fiction and Best First Book. I recently had a chance to chat with Ruiz, who makes his home in San Antonio. Well, you're a native of Brownsville, and that town is a pretty prominent character in many of your stories, as are border communities, I think, in general, or even immigrants in general. You tend to make the pieces not quite autobiographical, but you do tend to put pieces of yourself in some of the stories. And I was remembering there is a story inside of your short story collection, Seven for the Revolution, about a young boy who wants to save money to buy his Evel Knievel bike. And so he becomes sort of this chili candy dealer to his schoolmates. And it wasn't until I was researching you a little bit later on your website that that little boy was you.
That's right. That's right. That particular story was very autobiographical. It's mostly true. I was in elementary school and I was inspired to start my own little business. But basically at the time, my family was living across the border in Matamoros to be close to my grandparents. And we would commute every day to this little Catholic school in Brownsville with a group of friends. And because I was in Matamoros, I could buy the authentic Mexican chile packets for 5 cents, let's say, or a peso at the time. This would have been like in the early 80s or late 70s. And then come across and then sell the chile to my classmates, and I would double the, you know, double the price. So I would make a good little profit, but I'd sell the packets for a dime, you know. It was a lot of fun. And during lunch breaks, I'd be surrounded by kids out in the playground. I'd be have my box of chile, and it opened my eyes to the fact that there was so much opportunity on the border, and it was like a firsthand experience with trade, you know. And my kids, actually, when I became a father, they loved that story. I would tell like a little bedtime story version of that story, and they would love it. And they would always tell me, "Dad, tell us the chile story." So it inspired me to write down the story and make it into something that could be shared with a broader audience, you know. I saw in that story that there was a lot of potential in mining those childhood memories. I was lucky to be surrounded by just amazing people that were great characters in and of themselves. My mom, my dad, my abuelita, you know. So you see those characters resurface in various guises, and I'll bring back aspects of their personas and then, of course, kind of fictionalize them.
Well, I think those of us also who grew up on the border, we have a familiarity with those characters already. You know, we have an abuelita, or maybe there was somebody in the family who might have a little bit of a supernatural ability. Oh, she always knows what's going to happen, you know. They wouldn't exactly call her bruja, but, you know, it was, oh, that's scary.
Exactly.
How did she know that?
Exactly. And I guess when you've been on Earth for 80, 85 years, maybe you've seen it all, so you kind of know what's going to happen next. But to a youngster, you know, that seems like, wow, that person has a psychic ability. And there's magic to that, too, of course, and we want to believe. One of the most rewarding things for me as a writer has been that when I've had the opportunity to read or do a reading at a college with a large group of Latino students, for instance, I get comments often from the students that say, "This is the first time that I read a story that I felt like I could see myself and the people I know in my family, like, in the story. And I was like, that happened to me, or that happened to my mom, or my abuelita told me something similar. And that's very rewarding to me, because it inspires, hopefully, others to look in their own lives and in our culture to share their stories with other people and see the value in that.
Well, let's get back to the magical realism you're talking about. The most recent story that I've read of yours called Vexing Gifts, it not only, I think, is magical realism, but it's almost dystopian. You know, it almost has an almost apocalyptic feel. It's set on the border in Brownsville, and it incorporates many realities, but yet amplifies them to where you think this can never happen, but really could it? So in this particular story, we were talking about the psychic abuelita. There's an abuelita who kind of foretells the future. She tells her grandson that when it snows in the summer, make sure you go to the other side of the border. There will be a monument of fear that will have gone up. And so between the time that abuelita dies and the present is revealed in the story, a giant, super, super tall wall has gone up. And President Trump's name is not mentioned, but he is very heavily implied in the story. I won't reveal exactly how. But again, this wall that is so high where if people were trying to climb it, they would not be able to breathe because the oxygen is so thin. Again, that's just a version of a wall that is just so amplified. Drones are incinerating people who are trying to get across. Very strict, deadly immigration policies, almost reminiscent of the Berlin Wall. Can you explain how you come to just sort of take these things that exist and just make them so amplified where they almost seem so unreal?
Yeah, I was inspired really to write this story back during the 2016 presidential campaign, and I wrote it before President Trump was elected. And partially the long process that it took, almost 2 years to get it published and in print, is an example of just the writer's world, you know, how long it takes to get things out. But it was inspired really by Trump's rhetoric during the campaign, the talk of the wall, the horrible characterization of Mexican immigrants that really became the hallmark of his campaign from his announcement. And also from having studied literature, I was reminded of the power of satire. And like, for example, I think back to like Jonathan Swift and his writings, you know, way back in England, where he exaggerated proposed policies to really show the cruelty and the inhumanity and how terrible the outcomes could be if those policies were really enacted and pursued. And then that way help make people question, do these policies represent the values of our society? Like, is this who we want to be? And I think that type of satire and that type of sort of hyperbole that you can definitely see happen in magical realism, because magical realism is all about sort of exaggerating things, but then having elements that are real. So it feels like part of the real world, but it's not exactly. And also another part of what inspired me to take that approach was, you think about various episodes in history, like for example, the episode of the Japanese internment camps during World War II. People look back now and they go, how could that have been possible that Japanese Americans, that American-born Japanese citizens were being taken from their homes, put in camps, losing everything that they had, being separated from their families often? It happened. You know, it happened here, and it happened not that long ago when you really think about it. So to me, what history shows us is that it's a slippery slope. So you start going down this path, you could end up in a very horrible place.
And so going a little further into the story, I think people who are familiar with Brownsville know that there is a SpaceX facility there. You know, they're going to be testing some rockets soon that will eventually, they say, take men to the moon or to Mars. And that particular facility is implied in the story. And that's kind of what leads to almost doomsday on the U.S. side of the bridge. And ironically, everybody is trying to escape into Mexico. And I sense some of that irony in your other stories as well. You know, people who want to so escape plight and poverty and persecution in Central America and Mexico in the United States, all of a sudden you have Americans wanting to flee into Mexico. And I know you have a few stories like that in your book, Seven for the Revolution. So again, twisting the narrative, and that's kind of what you put forth in some of your stories.
Absolutely. You know, I think that my thinking behind that is I was really raised believing in that old axiom of that you should treat other people the way that you would like them to treat you.
The
golden rule. And I think that that's something universal that is part of American culture, American values, regardless of race and ethnicity. That's something that anyone can relate to, no matter what their political views are. So if you sort of create a story where that philosophy is underneath the story, driving the story, a person with that value can have their eyes open and realize, hey, it could be me tomorrow that needs help. It could be America that falls on hard times and needs their neighbor. So when times are good and you're riding high, how are you, should you treat your neighbors? Should you turn them away, devalue their humanity, or should you treat them the way that you'd like to be treated if the tables were turned? And that's pretty simple thinking, really, but to try to put it in a story where it doesn't feel so much like you're preaching to the audience, but rather help them feel that and have them come to that own realization, hopefully through the story of what it would feel like if they were on the other side.
Well, I hope I've given a rambling example of what the story Vexing Gifts is about, but would you be able to read an excerpt from the story?
Absolutely. I'd love to.
Thanks.
Love to. So this is a part of the story where you mentioned that the wall had been built, and after the wall is built, there is subsequent deportations. So that's kind of where we're at in the story. And I'll start with a paragraph that kind of captures what you were describing earlier, where I don't mention anyone by name. The name of the notorious tyrant who built the wall was emblazoned across its facade in gold leaf, just as it crowned buildings to the north. We mouthed it in a baffled mixture of wonder, dread, and disgust. Amidst the chaos of millions displaced, some of us were erroneously ejected alongside the undocumented. Torn from beds and disrupted slumber, pried from the clutches of screaming children orphaned and left in our care, dragged through the streets to the exit. After all, we shared the same names, spoke the same language, reflected the same spectrum of light from our sun-baked skin. These were very easy mistakes to make, but not so easy to correct. There existed laborious procedures to retrieve these family members extracted from our corpus like stolen organs, to re-ingest them from the other side of the impermeable wall, but it could take years and thousands of dollars simply to prove that they had been born in our country and that they had attended school and paid taxes and given birth to children and fought in crusades on foreign sands in defense of our national interests. And while we had time, we didn't have money. We were not wealthy or powerful or influential. We did not possess foreign bank accounts and retain lawyers and tax accountants. We did not revel in the sight of our surnames gleaming in giant gold letters at the pinnacles of skyscrapers or emblazoned across mammoth walls of historic proportions. So we became smaller, diminished by our loss. We grew weaker and more timid. We shriveled and shirked as the military convoys rumbled and rolled through our town's dusty streets, shaking our homes from the faltering foundations to the rattling windows to the creaking rafters. We cowered in the shadow of the wall.
That's writer Rudy Ruiz reading from his latest short story, Vexing Gifts. It was published in the summer-fall 2018 issue of the Notre Dame Review. When we come back, more with Rudy Ruiz. And we'll get a sneak peek of a giant tree of life that tells the story of San Antonio's rich ranching history.
So we have 700 stories collected from the community that have been realized, essentially, you know, converted into a physical artifact.
That's next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Rudy Ruiz is an award-winning writer. His 2013 short story collection, Seven for the Revolution, was recognized at the 2014 International Latino Book Awards. His short story, That Boy Could Run, won the 2017 Gulf Coast Prize in Fiction. A native of Brownsville, Ruiz is currently CEO of Interlex Communications in San Antonio. Interlex is a corporate social marketing agency. Ruiz not only employs fiction to advocate for social causes, but through this communications agency, he helps clients make positive impacts in the lives of their diverse audiences, who are often traditionally underserved populations.
When I finished school, my background had been not only in creative writing and literature, but also public policy. So back in 1995, my wife, Heather, and I started a company called Interlex that's based here in San Antonio, and it's an advocacy marketing firm. And our idea was to help transform public policy into social action. It also goes the other way, trying to transform social action into public policy.
Well, give us an example.
Well, we've done over the years a lot of campaigns, such as like the state of Texas immunization campaigns for the Department of State Health Services. We've done a lot of national campaigns having to do with helping to reduce smoking among teenagers, about fighting the obesity epidemic, things like that. So we've done a lot of public awareness and education campaigns, as well as a lot of public health related work. And when we started out, my dream was always to be a writer, but you also have to pay the bills, of course, and it takes a while to get your writing published. And so the agency that we started was a way for us to take our talents. My wife's a designer and I'm a writer, merge them together and do something that we could feel good about, but also make a living.
And also make your parents proud, right? Oh, Mijo, you're never going to make a living as a writer.
Absolutely. There's a little bit of making them proud and a little bit of proving them wrong at the same time. But, you know, that worked out, has worked out really well. And then it was actually back during the 2008 presidential campaign when Barack Obama was running for president that, like many people, I was very, very inspired by his message and by him as a leader. And that inspired me to start doing some writing that was more political commentary. So not only have I written fiction, but I got into writing a lot of op-eds and political commentary. I started a website back then called redbrownandblue.com, and it was basically about multicultural perspectives on large mainstream issues and bringing those perspectives to the mainstream. Through that organization, we were able to develop a partnership with CNN back around 2009, 2010, and so had quite a good reach for a while getting that kind of political commentary out there. And then after a few years, I kind of pivoted back towards the fiction. The great thing about writing for the news is that you can get your stories out there faster, as you know. So it doesn't take 2 years to get a story out there because by then it's old news. So, you know, all the different types of writing have their rewards to them and their challenges to them. But I love doing all the different kinds, you know, whether it's the advocacy, public awareness type messaging that we've done at work, at Interlex, to the political commentary, to the fiction writing. It's a lot of fun.
We've been talking with award-winning writer Rudy Ruiz. Ruiz is CEO of the corporate social marketing agency Interlex Communications in San Antonio. To hear more of our conversation, including how Gabriel Garcia Marquez influenced his writing and what Ruiz has in the works, visit tpr.org. Public art is typically defined as artwork that enhances public spaces. But what happens when you involve the public in the creation of public art? I had a chance to get a sneak peek of a giant tree of life that's not only a jewel for an area mission, but an expression of San Antonio's ranching history. In spring 2017, San Antonians from all walks of life gathered to share their stories in charlas, charrettes, and their stories were realized and transformed into clay structures. Those structures now hang from the massive Árbol de la Vida, Tree of Life, just off a trail between the San Antonio River and the nearly three-century-old Mission San Francisco de la Espada. Robert Ammerman, executive director of the San Antonio River Foundation, says the clay sculptures come in all shapes and sizes.
They range from a couple of pounds for the little infill pieces that the kids at elementary and middle schools made to, I think, the largest piece is about 500 pounds.
The artist behind the project, Margarita Cabrera, worked diligently to involve the community on this massive project.
I've never made a public artwork this large. The piece is 40 feet tall and 80 feet across, and it holds 700 ceramic sculptures made by community members. And they gifted San Antonio and all of us these beautiful stories, very compelling stories, stories that were personal to them, personal to their families, personal to their communities.
And nearby Floresville is the ranching outpost to the Mission Espada, the Rancho de las Cabras, the Ranch of the Goats. It also dates back nearly 300 years. Cabrera, whose family descended from the Canary Islanders, who were some of San Antonio's earliest settlers, discovered another tie to the region while researching the project.
And while walking the grounds of El Rancho de las Cabras, I came across a historic marker that read, El Rancho de la Familia Cabrera. And I realized then that there was a connection to my family history and the history of this amazing city.
Robert Ammerman of the San Antonio River Foundation says the sculpture is a love letter to San Antonio.
Because of all the stories that were collected and the importance of kind of our history and the diversity of our culture and how that culture gets together, I love that that's literally embodied into this piece. So we have 700 stories collected from the community that have been realized, essentially, you know, converted into a physical artifact that will last for generations.
The sculpture will officially be unveiled in mid-May. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz, and our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.